Whatever the fuck we're going to talk about.
Like a real kind of spontaneous energy when you get rocked by two of the
everyone.
Panel. Yeah, pretty much.
Welcome to Game of Nodes, a weekly podcast from independent validator teams.
Hello and welcome to Game of Nodes, weekly podcast from some validator teams and not from others. To be fair, one of the panel is not here today because of actually having to be up for a significant portion of the night, I gather. So I didn't have to be up during the night other than baby duty. So I feel like I don't really have a leg to stand on by criticizing that. Usurper also has quite a good excuse. So, but Noel shaved. You shaved for this episode for those guys and they didn't show up. And here you are, all clean shaven, like you're going into the corporate job.
I'm incredibly disappointed. I'm getting ready for consensus. This is my preparations for consensus. So
you're shaving now 2 weeks out.
Yeah, so I've got a stubble instead of stubble.
I was going to shave today, but then I remembered it was the podcast. So we're a beardy boy. I'm very jealous about consensus. It was one of those classic things where I didn't think I was going to be able to do it. And then I was like, oh, no, wait, I think actually logistically, I think I can do it. And then as soon as I looked at it and talked it through, it was like, oh, no, there's actually like a whole bunch of stuff going on that I need to be here for, sadly. But maybe next year. Did you do it last year or did you just do ETH Denver last year?
Just ETH Denver. It's far too far to go multiple times a year over to the other side of the planet.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, other side of the planet is kind of everywhere from Australia though, so.
I mean, like, you know.
Well, everywhere other than like Thailand and China, basically.
Japan's still just there. Across the planet. Man, most of the population's on my side, so I don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
Most of the population of what? Australia?
The planet.
Well, hang on. which side are we talking about? Are we talking about the Southern Hemisphere?
Or are we talking about Southern Hemisphere, like the meridians. In my meridians, my time zone, plus or minus 5, we've got a lot of people here.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, fair.
Yeah, so, you know. You might talk big over your just you know, I get it. Your side of the planet has like a bit of GDP going on, but we got people, so you know.
Yeah, I was about to try and pull a kind of bait and switch brown guy move there, and then I realized I'm the wrong type to be in this that band of time zones, so it doesn't even work. Can't even claim diaspora points on that one. So time zones, huh? So anyway, what are you looking forward to consensus? I genuinely am going to FOMO the shit out of it because I had psyched myself up for going and then was like, oh no, actually I can't go.
Look, would it surprise you if I told you I genuinely don't know what is going to be there?
No, that would not surprise
me. Let me rephrase. What am I excited about? I'm excited about hooking up with the squad again for another year. Having some good times with our validator brethren and, you know, in going to the consensus, seeing what's new, trying to connect up with people. That's what it's all about at the conferences, right? It's more of the people. I didn't go there for the conference itself. I go there because that's where all the people are.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing, especially about big conferences, is that if you... What I reminded myself of, because I did some last year for the first time in a few years, and what I was reminded of the really hard way is that if you are not prepared to be on it, you're just going to get very, very little out of it. And the actual conference itself is like obviously a distraction. Like there's almost no point in the conference show floor. I just remember like doing a couple and I was just super sleep deprived. And I was just like, what? And it was, It was brutal.
That's not going to work. You can't be like sleep deprived.
Also, when especially like the first three, four months of having a small human, you're just like it's probably literally for good evolutionary reasons. Like 100% of your brain power is just elsewhere. You're just like, is the human alive? Is the human alive? Is the human alive? And people are just like, yeah, so we have this issue with our infrastructure, the blah, 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 blah. And you're like, oh, fucking spend some money on better boxes. Jesus Christ. It wasn't quite that bad, but it wasn't far off. There were like maybe a couple of conversations where plausibly something could have come of it. And literally just went like, you don't need our help. You just need to spend some money on X, Y, or Z. That's easy. And you're like, ah, just... lost there or gave away 15 grand worth of free consultancy, and I'm not sure which, but either way, we're not getting paid.
That's how you fix most of the problems, just set fire to some Benjamins.
Yeah, but you want people to set fire to some Benjamins in your direction. That's how consulting kind of works, is my understanding. I'm not good at this business, the business of business.
So they set fire to Benjamins asking you how to set fire to more Benjamins. Yeah.
That's definitely, I don't know if you've ever had the reps for like OVH and all those other kind of providers are quite different, but the AWS reps are very like that. They're like, it's difficult. It seems like you're setting fire to a lot of Benjamins to run this service. How about if we go in one of our AWS accredited architects to help you restructure that on a cost basis? And you're like, there's no way that's going to end up cheaper for me. Are you mad?
planet does bringing another body in make things cheaper?
Well, also like from our, we had the, like what we like to call the fun month where our bill did genuinely get out of control. Our bill got out of control to the extent that when AWS did come for their money, they called me up and asked to be put through to our accounts department. And I think that's when you know that you've screwed up badly. I think I said at the time, you know, you screwed up badly when you get assigned an account manager with an actual dialing number by AWS who normally just do not give a shit. And you definitely know you're in trouble when any of your counterparties is like, can I speak to your finance department? Sorry, I think I might have the wrong number. You're the chief technical officer, right? And you're like, how many people do you think we have in our organization? Like,
that's when you really know you've fucked up, when they assume that there are multiple departments of people working there and you're like, how much money have I accidentally just spent?
when you're
spending enough money for them to think that you can afford to have people.
Yeah. Our peak AWS bill during the incident, as we like to call it, was bigger than what? Yeah, no. So I've worked in big companies where the AWS bill for that part of the engineering function was smaller per month. So like, you know, we're talking about like a function with like maybe 20 engineers or something like that. Their infrastructure bill was smaller. Oh dear, it was only for 1 month. The moral of that story is always have your AWS billing notifications set to weekly if you can, not monthly. And if your dashboard doesn't let you do it, then you should just make sure you have some other stuff like Slack reminders or whatever. Anyway, that was a long time in the past. So consensus, you're going to rock up, say to people, all right, cunts, What do you need doing? I can fix it. I'm your man. Hand over the Benjamins. And they're just going to roll over from the sheer size of your brass Australian balls. Is that it? That's the business development plan.
not quite like that, but I suppose.
Not far off, right?
No. Well, I'm hoping that I can actually, meet up with existing clients. Hopefully there will be some of those there. And I don't expect to go home with any more business in hand, but at least have some more contacts into, you know, up and coming protocols and new dApps, new developers. So, you know, it's not about, you're not going to sell someone on the spot, but you can definitely get a foot in the door, which is hard sometimes over the internet. So
yeah, it's 100% the case. I think like one of the things that I definitely feel like having now substantially more time and energy to actually do work properly and like to what I would call an acceptable standard is I just feel like I've missed out on a year of, I know we've been doing the podcast, but like other than like day-to-day news of what's actually kind of happening or happened past tense, like I'm just feel very out of the loop other than the limited exposure I suppose I have just from, I guess there are some things where just for research purposes I check in on various news things, I guess, on the reg. So I see some like, oh, that network is still not launched, or that network is going to, or that team has got VC or something like that. But I feel like very out of the loop on large networks launching, but like if there are like future projects and dApps and that kind of thing, which is that's a really good thing, to be fair, for going to one of these conferences, right? You can just like kind of wander around and meet those people, right?
Yeah, I think.
And also feel the buzz in the air, right?
Yeah, you get a better gauge of like what people are excited about. You get access to people, like, you know, particularly as, you know, obviously we run in a certain circle, so that circle in person generally, you know, gets you invites to different things and you can go and meet up with people. And it's even like, even just catching up with like other validators and being able to talk about stuff over a beer is, I think, valuable in the long run. You know, because this business is partly about relationships as well, even though like a lot of, you know, those types of validators and other service providers are your competition. I think it's important that, you know, you're all still sort of friendly with each other and talk. Like, you know, us, case in point, the group that does this, where we talk on a, you know, sometimes daily basis just about the goings on. And
which is probably accounts for the slightly, what's it called? The slightly diminished membership today, which is that we've already had a group call this week. We just didn't film it. Which actually leads on. So the fun and games of, hang on, we've had quite a few comments, which probably, okay. So mainly trolling on the basis of our, oh, hey, Shulzi, how's it going? You look tired.
I'm very tired. Very tired.
Ben Davis
maybe
says,
we should get Shulzi a pillow.
Shulzi, should Ben Davis sell some coins, some shit coins, to buy Foo Fighter gig tickets? There you go.
Ooh. I'm not the person to ask about that. I don't like the Foo Fighters.
Which shit coin? But which particular shitcoin are you talking about, Ben Davis? Like, if it's a, are we talking like 2021 now shitcoins, or are we talking like recent, currently shit meme coins? I don't know, because they've got different prospects.
Which coins have good prospects at the moment? I just see red.
Yeah, those red dildos have definitely been getting around.
Since the Bitcoin halving, it's just been down only.
I mean, if you look at history, that's not necessarily new. Usually right after the halving, there is a fair bit of a whackening.
Yeah.
There's usually a lead up into the halving and then a lull after the halving and then some sort of insane bullshit. But I mean, I think in the past, it's always... I think I've said this before, that there's usually, you know, some hype for the halvening, and then it happens and then everyone's like, oh, but then sometime shortly after, a lot of the time there is like a catalyst that sort of sets the candle alight. And I don't know that there is one right now. But you know, they tend to sneak up. Like the last one I think I've said before was COVID was the catalyst last time. And it just snuck up.
I mean, luckily, there's no potentially significant geopolitical events happening this year.
What? There's shit going on all over the place.
That's the joke.
All right.
It walked straight into it. Bam! It was like seeing a deer getting hit by a freight train. It was like that meme. That, you know, have you ever seen that old meme? It's like a GIF. Or maybe it's like a really short video clip, like potato quality of like, there's like a train going along, like a freight train, and a truck has like broken down on some level crossing, and the freight train just clips the front of the truck but keeps going, doesn't derail, and the truck just gets pushed back and actually gets away with it, and it's fine, and the train just keeps going and the truck is safe. And then right at the end of the video, a second train comes in from the other direction, smashes into the truck and derails.
Cool. You never story,
seen that
man.
Video? Yeah. It's like,
nope, never yeah, seen it.
Like, we're talking like old school internet, like 2009, mid-2000s, maybe even earlier than that. But I remember that the caption was, player two has entered. That's what it said right at the end of the thing before the video appears, like player two has joined. And all I can remember thinking was, I really hope nobody was in that truck. And then I was like, but actually, even if nobody was in that truck, somebody would have been driving that train. Yeah, almost certainly people died in that little video clip. Kind of dark.
Speaking of potatoes, did you find something? You mentioned potato. Speaking of potatoes, did you find something to run Geth on? Geth?
Well, no, we've been primarily... I gather you can run on anything. So probably just a cheat box from OVH or Hetzner. Well, I guess you can't run it on Hetzner, can you? So probably OVH is the plan.
Yeah, I'd stick with something not Hetzner if I were you.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it seems like pretty much any cheap dedicated server will do. All right, speaking of dedicated servers, one of the only things we still have like on AWS, we still got a TMKMS box. And we're going to replatform it soon. Are you still running DGen Horcrux for some stuff, or are you full Horcrux Raft?
Ultra fast still. I find Horcrux DGen is better. Just there's still some people struggling with the whole Raft thing with particular networks. So, but just we regardless, like we don't run them on our bare metal anyway. We keep all that stuff on DigitalOcean.
Right, okay, so yeah, fair enough. Yeah, I mean, we're on like you know, that's the one thing we have on AWS virtual instances, because worst case scenario you can just regen. What we're going to do is move all of the connections behind a dynamic DNS and then actually rebuild it to a new generation of AWS instance. But it feels like TMKMS is just abandonware at this point.
I would minimum run Horcrux in DGen. I wouldn't.
Yeah, so I'm kind of thinking is now the time to replatform? Because, the other thing is, like, we announced that we were shutting down Mars a few months ago and nobody – well, so I think we probably have a small number of delegators who are bigger delegators and we still haven't turned that off. So in the process of, like – when we do this, I'm kind of like, oh, well, I may as well just rebuild, like accept 5 hours of downtime, fully rebuild everything, turn off Mars, and then just DGen Horcrux the remaining stuff rather than continuing to run TMKMS, just like fully, like back up, snapshot the instance, and then nuke it from orbit so that it can't ever restart, and then just rebuild everything from Horcrux. Just get that ready on a separate box.
That seems overly cautious.
I mean, it's better to be. Yeah, I don't know. I take a bit of downtime rather than risk a double sign, I think is my attitude on that.
Well, you're only running like single sentries anyway, right?
I guess actually, yeah, that's a good point. Is that because you have the external ladder address, right? You're functionally can only ever listen to one external signer anyway. So DGen Horcrux actually protects you from a configuration fuck-up.
He won't let TMKMS connect. So
well, exactly. You're connecting to one or the other, aren't you? So actually, you don't even need to worry about it. You can just spin it up separately.
Yeah, obviously, like miss some blocks in between when you stop your sentry and restart it, but. Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
Once TMKMS isn't just going to fucking get cursed and start back up again if you disable the servers. Like it's doesn't just, I mean, like, stuff,
computers are pretty cursed, Noel. I think you should know that by now.
I mean, they're run by code. You tell it to do things and it does it.
Well, it doesn't. It often doesn't.
Well, it does. It's just
it often doesn't.
If you tell it to do something that you didn't realize to tell it to do, it'll do the thing. But if you tell it to
do the thing, except when it doesn't do the thing because of an application error or the halting problem.
Yeah, but if you tell something to not start, it won't start.
Unless there's a bug from some intersection of complicated things.
What, some zero-day bug in system D that's going to, like, re-enable a process? I don't think so, bub.
I mean, granted, like, low-level Linux stuff, unlikely, but the paranoia is still there. And, you know, serves this guy well. So,
I just got my notification for my calendar for the podcast, so I need to update some things.
Yeah, clearly you're not on UTC?
No, I'm not back into the not daylight savings time. This won't be a problem soon. We're moving to Queensland. There's no daylight savings up there. So.
Yeah, but why didn't you just fucking put it in UTC in the first place in your calendar, and then it will always adapt to your local time because it's the event is defined in UTC?
You might have a point.
That is why you do everything in UTC.
Yeah, I mean, I operate in UTC anyway, so.
Yeah. You just go into, like, somewhere in your Google calendar settings, you do default time for events, UTC, but then you tick the box or whatever it is where it says show in my time zone.
I actually just did that yesterday. I didn't realize you could do that until yesterday. Yep.
That's how I have mine set up so that it doesn't freak me out when people in other time zones are like, hey, I've put an event in, and you're like, it's just like, yeah, okay, it's really easy. And I just say, oh, is blah, 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 UTC a good time? And they go, yeah, blah, blah, blah. Those high-powered, complex business meetings I have as a half-assed, washed-up node operator / engineer. But, yeah.
It looks like, well, you can't do it in the Apple calendar.
I don't know about the Apple one. I got Gmail, baby.
Yeah, I mean, it is a Gmail account, but it looks like I'll have to actually log into Gmail to achieve that. But I can do that. We have the power. Yeah,
you have the technology. So, yeah.
Cool story, Hansel.
Cool story.
Yeah. So, Schiltzy, tell us about this failure to launch.
Failure to launch what?
You said you've been up all night trying to start a network.
No. There was a network called DWallet that was launching, and they did it from Israel time, like 3 p.m. Israel time, which was 2 a.m. my time. And so I was just up for their Genesis.
There was no problem. It was just that it was... at an inconvenient time.
Yeah. Yeah. I would actually contest that. I think the next bull market is going to be when a good advent of privacy chains comes out. That's my thought. I think that with more and more information coming out about how Bitcoin and Ethereum are truly not anonymous, they're pseudo-anonymous. I think whenever people start seeing like Secret Network and various ZK networks coming out, which aren't exactly private, but the nuance will be lost. I think that's when the excitement will really blow back up. That's relevant because DWallet is like a pseudo privacy chain, not actually pseudo privacy, but like it uses MPC. So every validator has its own key to create a form of privacy. And so that's what came to mind.
Outside of Cosmos ecosystem, then, I'm guessing?
It is, yeah. It's kind of a like an encryption stack built on top of Sui. It's going to use... It's not using Sui's stack as if it were the Cosmos SDK, I guess you could say. They forked Sui and then built on top of that.
Oh, really? That's interesting. So they chose Sui. Interesting. So they're still using the Move VM in that?
Yes. Yeah.
I guess there must be, yeah, because it's the move PM's tied to consensus, isn't it? Because stake. Yep. Interesting. So, like, but how? Which bits of that are anonymous then?
Great question. I don't think I really have the mental capacity to answer that question fully.
Shilty, are you a validator on Sweep?
No.
I'm not either. You're not, Frey.
No, did a very cursory bit of networking in that direction. Realized that every single fucker in the entire space was, and that there was no chance, and that we don't have the sheer energy and enthusiasm and resources of somebody like Artifact. And so, which went, this is not going to happen. Let's not waste this. But I think out of people we know, friends of the podcast, if you like, I think only Artifact are Sweep validators, at least Genesis validators.
Okay. Yeah, I met some random dudes here in Melbourne that were Sweep validators, and I'm like, oh, okay, what else do you validate? And they're like, no, this is the first one. We just knew some people. And I was like, really?
I have no idea. Like, is it profitable, like Sweep? Because their tokenomics and their model is pretty different.
It was for these guys. So, yeah.
Yeah.
They were making a like, decent clip.
There are, I think, 5 top validators on Sweep that have like something like $1 billion each delegated to them from the foundation. So they are definitely making good money.
Oh wow!
Yeah, that's always the way, isn't it? If you've got a sweet foundation delegation, you could be on, I don't know, Cosmos chain, and you could probably make a few bucks. Like,
so we've all been looking into the new hotness with DVT recently. This is where you comment. So yeah, I know we've been looking at
deep vein thrombosis,
distributed validator technology, OBOL SSV.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. Yes, we have. Greatly looking into.
And it's probably, I think Schultz might be too zonked to talk about it. But anywho, I should bring up this spreadsheet so I can look at the good work of Rama. And you'll be happy to know, the Frey, that I have sorted out my calendar to the UTC time. And if you guys don't unmute your fucking microphones and talk to me, I'm going to leave.
Very, very fragile. I was reading the spreadsheet to see what's in there. What was I going to say? The SSV stuff is kind of pretty interesting. I actually wonder as well if some of the threshold or pool or distributed validator stuff is kind of, it's an important technical thing. I don't think it's going to drive any kind of bull action because users don't give a shit, rightly so. But I think from a technology point of view, it's one of the things that needs, like, basically you just need lots and lots of different layers of things that mean that security, at least for any kind of proof of stake type model, that security is still happening, but distribution is greater. The missing piece of the puzzle, though, right, and it has always been this, is that fundamentally decentralization, in the terms that it's currently talked about and the terms that are probably most important, which is kind of resilience of the network, like pure resilience of the network, in terms of like what somebody like JP Verne would call like good old decentralization, I think it relies very, very heavily, the incentive structure, on validators making money. Duh. And the problem is, for users, actually, you want so many validators that they don't make money, unless the market cap is massive. And it just follows that there's almost no chains where the market cap is substantial enough that you get, like, the idea that you get completely blue collar validators is ridiculous because of the technical overhead to do it, right? So then you need to go, okay, well, it has to be the other end of the sublime to the ridiculous, and it has to be consumer hardware, you know, just like Bitcoin was, you know, before it got popular, like way back in the day, like Bitcoin, Dogecoin, Litecoin. I mined some of that on my university laptop, you know, which was not a great laptop. Like those before they were popular, where you could just run it on your laptop in the background. You kind of go back to that model. Like, I don't know, is that kind of feels like the only kind of thing that's ultimately long term going to work, right? It just has to be that level of foolproof for end users to actually secure the network, right? And the buy-in probably needs to be pretty low.
Yeah, well,
proof of stake anyway, like.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man. I mean, isn't the ultimate goal that everyone can run their validator on a potato, like the Light client future? Yeah.
I mean, I think the ultimate goal, go all the way back to, I know this wasn't kind of said then, but there was some stuff around this kind of subject. Like when we had Henry from Penumbra on, the probably the end goal is basically as much of the stack as possible wants to be on the end user's device. Like the control, like all of this stuff that we currently run, like the foundations, right? They write a cracking press release on how this is the blockchain for the people and you will own the blockchain. It's like, well, no, because you're still like beholden to validators running the software and a foundation who controls all the money. So actually it's like probably even more centralized than your average nation state, just because there's fewer people involved. So like it's kind of like
the whole foundation side of thing is like pretty interesting, because ideally there wouldn't be one. But
what's it, you know what, this is the one thing that I think genuinely, I don't know that it will get much credit for this, because A, nobody knows because it's in Cosmos, and B, nobody gives a shit as a result. But I genuinely think that is one of the things that Juno was quite interesting for. Like, obviously, Bitcoin just launched without a foundation. Great. And that's cool. And because of its mechanism, it was able to prosper ultimately. But I think like that became very, very uncommon. And I think actually like the kind of Juno model of chains launching, if it were sustainable to launch in that way and continue development, is actually really interesting. And I think that's like closer to the ideal. The problem is that Juno launched without a plan. It launched without a team, a development team anyway. And there was no long-term thinking around.
Well,
like, Juno, and that's fine if you end up with like a market cap enough that you have people whose economic incentive is such that they will continue to work on it and they'll build a company and blah, 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 blah. Like those things are possible. But like, so it's back to the kind of the central problem of proof of stake, which is that most proof of stake networks, because of something in their stack, whether that's the core software or the economic incentives or the tokenomics or anything, there's something in their stack that assumes my market cap. And if it's not there, then eventually the wheels come off. Like that's like, it's very hard to prove that claim. That's why it's just like a kind of out there claim. But that's like, you look at so many and you're like, it just feels like that's an underlying assumption that this will be the next Ethereum and thus the problems will be solved. It's like, no, probably not.
I think, well, there's a couple of things to unpack, but you know, on the foundations, like, foundations are, they're like a catch 22. Like, you kind of need them to funnel funds into things that support the network, right? If you don't have them, the networks are kind of rudderless. But by having them, you then have a situation where someone basically controls the chain anyway. So you can't be decentralized. But I mean, we've talked about this before as well, like whether or not things necessarily need to be decentralized, and that really depends on what their purpose is. But I mean, all of these chains are like just beta software problem solving. Like, everyone's got the newest hotness every other week at the moment, and a lot of people just copy each other and get something out there to fund further development. When, you know, like, a lot of these things aren't going to survive and just be ghost chains at some point. And it's hard to, like, you know, everyone wants to be the next Ethereum, but really, at this point, what would you need Ethereum to have to actually be Ethereum. The next Ethereum? Yeah, like everyone's always going to turn back to Ethereum and say, well,
yeah,
how can we do this new hotness but on Ethereum where all the money is? So
yeah,
it is.
Unless you offer something fundamentally different that users will actually gravitate to and you'll get mass adoption, that's the only way you become the next Ethereum, right? And
yeah, well, it's the next because it's not necessarily the next Ethereum.
It's the next Ethereum. It's just the thing, right? Because
Because originally, like, you know, Bitcoin was the next because it wasn't paper money, right? And then there's things that Bitcoin just fundamentally can't do, although it's a completely new category of finance. Then you have Ethereum came along and it was the next because it did something completely different to what Bitcoin was doing. It still had a token like Bitcoin, and it was still mined in a similar way to Bitcoin, but it was the smart contract thing. That was the next. And I don't know, maybe like the ZK stuff and privacy might be the next now, but you know, in terms of all the other things like going faster, you know, different ways of doing the same thing is probably not going to be the next.
No, I mean, I've kind of put my money on the table. I think it's just a fundamental reorganization of what is important about this technology is the thing that needs to happen next. And I just don't think, I think that in the longer term, people will decide which bit of the technology is useful to them, payments, building economic systems with smart contracts, whatever. And they'll pick that component and then they won't use a blockchain. Like, I think the blockchain bit is the bit that will go away. I don't think blockchains have a future. I think the cryptography does. I think the consensus mechanisms do. I think the protocol focus and the way that the protocols work does will. And I think like that's why IBC is super important, because I think like there's a lot of things you can learn from IBC to build a meta network where the network is what we currently look at as the Cosmos ecosystem. Like, I think that model where you go, okay, what would happen if you built IBC first? If you built IBC first and you were like, this is the most important thing that we're building and we want to get it adopted for a couple of use cases, and then you get a couple of people who have actually good use cases to then adopt it and kind of build it from the inside out. I mean, and I'm not saying that that's like not what's happened with IBC, and I'm not saying the people that work on IBC haven't thought of that as a strategy. I'm not trying to trash on anybody. I'm just kind of observing that, like, fundamentally on a kind of this causal basis, this happened and this happened and this happened, Tendermint, Cosmos, SDK, IBC, right? That's the order. When things have a certain order, there's always an implied set of decisions that are grandfathered in, right, by the process at every step. And yeah, I'm just kind of like, and I know that there are networks that work like this, Arbitrum, stuff like that. You know, this is not a new, this is not a big brain idea. I think there's quite a few different ways of cutting it. I think the blockchain being like an implementation detail that nobody cares about is like, that feels to me more compelling. So I don't think currently how we do blockchains is bad. I don't think end users care about blockchains. They care about certain outcomes that they are told blockchains deliver, which they don't always actually deliver. And a lot of the value is actually in the other bits in the stack, like consensus mechanism, like, you know, building smart contract stuff, like settling payments, all that kind of thing. And there's just like a lot of different parts of that. Like, you know, if you were in a big company and you had a user flow and you were like, I want to make a payment, and you would like map out all the steps and all the pages the user needs to go through that, all the actions they take. And like right now, we're just like, I need currency. And you're like, oh, damn, we failed at step one. Oh, no. Like there's so many different pieces. Back to like we're early. There are so many pieces of the puzzle that don't exist yet, or like don't exist in a good way. And like the fucking state of stable coins is like that. Like, I fucking hate the, yeah, whatever. Anyway, not important. But I don't know. There's so much interesting stuff like on the theory side, like in that direction, but like, I have no idea how it's going to thrash out in the real world, or whether it will. Yeah. And it's also interesting, like you were saying, on the privacy side of things, like how long we've had Zcash and how niche that technology still kind of is. Like, I think Schulze is kind of right that it's a good bet for something that will be really important next. But
I think it's kind of hard for it to proliferate, given like the history of people getting arrested. And I think that that spooked people and stifled development for a fair while. I mean,
that's kind of like the angle, I guess the angle I've come to on that is like, you know, what do I work on? I work on digital cash, right? Really, really specifically, like it's the thing that I'm part of a research group on. And I think it's because you can talk about cash and people like you can, there is a certain kind of heavy hand on the regulation mindset that hates cash, right? That kind of classic meme of like, they wouldn't invent cash tomorrow, right? It's, you know, it's trustless. It's always fungible, even if it's been stolen. It's first spend anonymous in a lot of situations. There's just all sorts of reasons why you wouldn't want it. And, you know, like Graeber's book, Debt, has a whole bunch of worrying societal problems that can happen when you have the proliferation of cash usage over credit. So there's also an equilibrium that needs to happen in an economy for like the good of all actors in the economy. But there are a bunch of low trust economic transactions where cash is a really, really good thing for the average consumer. And I think you can make that argument, right, to a government or a regulator. And because everybody knows what cash is, you can so easily explain why it's reasonable to expect to use cash, even in a digital space. And you kind of see a version of this, you know, like how you get an online bank and you can usually get like a one-time debit card code.
It blows up, like
a lot of banks do this thing, I think Apple Pay might do it, where you get a one-time use of a, so you can like put it into a, like,
oh, you know, no, they have a algorithmic card number. You never use the same card number twice.
So there are like various things where, so obviously that doesn't give you any privacy, whatever. That's actually about counterparty trust, right? But there are a whole bunch of things where people recognize that there's a user risk and they innovate a solution. And to be clear, cash doesn't protect you in that situation. I'm not saying it does, but I don't know. It feels like if you could, in the same way as that kind of problem, that counterparty risk problem where they're like, right, okay, we're going to solve it with this. There are a whole bunch of problems where I think if you illustrated it with a good enough example and you said, oh, as it happens, cash solves this, you can make that argument and you can get digital cash. And then if you strip away all of the like really intense vibes of something like Zcash to being like, no, it's just like normal cash. I don't know. Maybe you get privacy. I don't know. Maybe I'm huffing the hopium.
Maybe there needs to be, we'll call it phrase chain and phrase chain, code name cash, and we'll just connect Cassandra to IBC. Bam, I know how much of a fan of Cassandra you are.
Yeah, I low-key have to design a blockchain at the moment. It's a long story. I kind of think of using RocksDB as the storage engine, but yeah.
So just don't make it a blockchain. Make it an immutable instance of Cassandra, rewrite Cassandra, that connects to IBC and Wormhole.
It's kind of not a blockchain. Well, it's kind of a blockchain. What is a blockchain, though? Like... Like, I guess the simplest version of blockchain, right, is the previous, you have a hash, it points back to its previous, right? That's it. That's a blockchain. Does it have to be a memory?
State, yeah, it's like it's immutable state.
Right, but you have a blockchain that's just in memory. It doesn't have to be saved anywhere.
What do you mean?
Well, so if I just create a bunch of blocks, right, in memory and didn't persist them to disk or anything, like it'd still be a blockchain. It's still a list of hashes. You can still navigate them, traverse backwards.
To what end? If you you can lose that quite easily. I don't understand.
I'm just kind of pointing out like the assumptions. When we say blockchain, we actually mean distributed immutable ledger. we don't mean blockchain.
Well, no.
Stuff, obviously. But
a blockchain doesn't necessarily have to be distributed at all. You can have a blockchain just run on one thing. You can do away with the whole validators and everything and just have a single instance of a chain that just looks at the previous block and verifies it.
Well, so you can also have when you like, so this is because I've spent too much of the last month reading papers on consensus, and what's there, there's so many interesting decision points basically about when you like it. So obviously if you take performance, we're talking about purely theoretical, right? So take performance out of the picture. That's really important before I say anything obviously dumb. But like the decision points at which you decide to tell other nodes in a hypothetical network about what you know about the world and how you replicate that state and that state machine and everything. It like is really, really fascinating. Like all of the things you can do when you start relaxing assumptions, of which like, I mean, I guess like maybe this is just me. After being working in the space in this particularly like mainly on one version of a blockchain stack, like as soon as you just start throwing out all the assumptions about the thing that you've worked on and around for 3 years, and you go, okay, like let's relax this to being one node. Let's relax this to being whatever. Let's say that they only broadcast at these points. Let's say that they gossip this, or let's say that that's a Merkle tree and it's cumulative. So we don't even give a shit about the transactions. We don't give a shit about ordering. We just put it in a tree. It's really, really interesting to see how people solve all these individual problems, especially like asynchrony and whatever.
All these mechanisms are just there to create a distributed trustless environment. Like if you, for example, just wanted to make a blockchain that just is completely trusted by the operator and runs on one machine, like you can do away with so much of that overhead, because it's only, a lot of that overhead is only there so that it can be trustless and distributed. But
okay. But you don't even need,
if you just completely trust the previous state, you don't even need to include a hash of it in the, like if you only care about the current state, I can't see why you would even need to.
Well, you just need a database. You don't need a blockchain, obviously. But if you only care about current state, right, you're just doing updates in place, right? At which point you don't need a blockchain. In fact, you could just do that as a file on disk. Like,
yeah, as I'm thinking about it, it just becomes less and less like a blockchain if there's no. So yeah, really the whole chaining is only to create the trustless distributed.
So block. Well, the other thing it's to create, right, is that you having a history, like having entropy, having like an arrow of time allows you to create sorry, this is going to get super, super pretentious. There is a sense in which a system that is completely zero trust needs to have something outside of itself, something exogenous to itself, in order to even be able to be referenced, right? To have any sense of value or external reference or anything. And like the arrow of time is like important in that. And there's like a needlessly complex piece of thinking, which is that, so you know, like proof of work, right? It's just that you have processing power outside the system. It secures the network, proof of stake, the economic stuff secures the network, happy days, right? But like the part of basically the arrow of time, like knowing previous states, is actually quite desirable in a crash fault tolerant system. So let's say we know all of the operators who are going to run the network, right? We start a company. It's called Noel's Big Balls Enterprise Software Company. It's not a good name. We can work on that. It's an umbrella company of Noel's Big Balls blockchain company, I guess. What we build is ledger software for multinational companies, right? It turns out, so we get this big deal with Megacorp, Widget Corp, whatever, and they're just like, hey, okay, whatever nationality I say here is going to be offensive to that nationality. I'm sorry in advance. I'm just going to pick one. Norwegian. This is not reflective of Norwegian technical aptitude. I'm sorry. It's just an illustrative example. So you're selling this into the Australian office of Widget Corp, right? Which is obviously, Widget Corp are a famous Australian company. They're very big, aren't they? In Australia, but they have a big big Norwegian office as well, right? And so you're talking to the Australia, the CEO in Australia, behind his big desk, and he says, "Null. What I'm really concerned about, this is great. This software you've got is great. It's crash fault tolerant. Happy days. We're not going to lose any of these invoices. Amazing. What I'm worried about is that the Norwegian office, they're a bunch of Yahoos. You know what I mean? They are dingoes. I don't know. Whatever. What would an Australian person say if they were trying to make somebody, like, be shady to somebody in a business scenario? They're not just going to call them cunts, are they?
Probably.
So the Norwegian office, null. The problem I have, you're like, I want to solve the biggest problem you have, CEO man, Crocodile Dundee. And he goes, the biggest problem I have is that Norwegian office are a bunch of cunts. No, he doesn't. He says, the biggest problem I have is that all of my individual divisions in country are potentially, their software will go down, not because they're not good engineers, but because their data center goes out or their local power is unreliable. We have some folks that are in, you know, places where there are typhoons and shit, right? And power goes down, and we had an issue where a backup generator went down, and blah, 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 blah. Like, I have a friend that works for Cisco, right? And they had a problem where a US data center got taken out by Hurricane fucking Katrina, right? They get the, you know, there's named big US hurricanes come in and take out a whole data center, take out the backup power, flood the place. So, you know, for them, the fact that Apache Cassandra or whatever it might be is data center partitioned and fault tolerant is, like, really important, right? So one of the things, we're finally arriving at the point, one of the things that's interesting, obviously, about blockchains, distributed ledgers, like the stuff we work on, is that Byzantine fault tolerance, by definition, covers crash fault tolerance, right? So if you can get a system like that to be fast enough for your use case, there is an argument, and there's a good argument, for just going, fuck it, have a Byzantine fault tolerant ledger. And so this is where I've got to, like, I am working on a permissioned private chain for a really specific use case, like an architecture for it. And everybody was like, oh, it needs to do these really simple things. It needs to do blah, 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 blah. And I started asking questions like, oh, but how much do you trust institution X or Y or Z to be up? And they were like, oh, they'll be down all the time. And you're like, okay, cool. And you just start, like, you go down the list. They've got like 20 institutions or whatever that are going to run this. You go down the list and you get 8 nodes down, right? And they're like, okay, all of these are going to be down. And you're like, what? That's like a third of the network is now crash faulted, right? We are into consensus algorithm territory where we are now in problem zone, right? Multiples of 3, baby. And so at that point, you're like, well, fuck it. It sounds like we're building a zero trust network now. It sounds like we're because a Byzantine fault, like, well, a Byzantine fault is different from a crash fault. Like, that's a given. Because a Byzantine fault, you say one thing and you do another, right? But it's also possible for a node to broadcast one thing, but do another thing because of misconfiguration. Like, tombstoning is almost always a configuration error that results in that mismatch, right? A Byzantine fault, but it's usually actually operator error. So there's a whole system, there's a whole class of enterprise systems where that's definitely true of. And I don't know, that's kind of fascinating. And it's going to be it is endlessly fascinating, actually. Yeah, I don't know. To me, of course, it's fascinating to me. That's literally what. I enjoy. I'm a masochist. I enjoy reading papers about all of the different ways in which these systems can fail, I suppose. But I get that's not everybody. That's not everybody's kink.
So should we then move on to some news before everybody goes to sleep or leaves? One of the two.
Yeah.
Like, I'm here to talk about other stuff, man. All right, so let's go. I'm going to read this verbatim, so hopefully it's good. Huge news for privacy and P2P crypto enthusiasts as local Monero to shut down the P2P exchange after 7 years of operation. After Monero began delisted from multiple exchanges, now the largest privacy P2P exchange is closing with new account creations already disabled and trading to cease on the 19th of May. The website will shut down in November. So this was a privacy exchange. Do you know about this, Schultzy?
Think so.
Schultzy, like what?
I do not know about it. No, I've read about it, but I don't really know what it does.
I don't know why my camera has still working. Apparently, I had to plug it in recently because it was running out of battery fast. I still have my phone taped to my monitor, and it runs out of battery when we do this. So.
There you go. You know, I think I used to have some Monero, but I'm guessing I now can't do shit with it. So, oh well, too many coins, too many wallets.
You're saying you have Monero and just don't know where it is?
I definitely used to have some Monero. Yeah, I don't know if I still have it. I should probably check. If it's been delisted from a bunch of exchanges, then I should probably check whether I sold it or not. Otherwise, it's back to literally. This is why you need. I genuinely think that a lot of this stuff is just, I don't know. Presumably, is the reason that people are going after this stuff because it's private exchanges? Is the reason that governments go after it because of AML, CFT, or is it because of perceived user harm? No, it's gone. It's done. It's like, we're into policy debates now.
Literally sounded like someone just walked into my house. Kind of hard to tell with headphones on, so I'll be back in a minute.
After what, 100 episodes, the phone finally falls off the monitor and smashes into the desk mid-podcast.
It had to happen at some point.
Amazing. Okay, so that's bad. I wonder where they're based. A local Monero based in the States? Is that why they're being shut down or whatever? Because it seems like getting shut down seems like a thing that you have to be in a jurisdiction where you can be shut down. Internal and external factors. That's very MISC.
I mean, one of the interesting issues with a lot of these tools is that they're passion projects, right? And so people don't have a lot of reason to continue developing it once they've done something. And a good example of this Monero related is the Secret Network Monero Bridge. Right now there is Monero on Secret, yes, but the person who developed it has no reason to continue. And so now this bridge basically doesn't work anymore, at least when last time I tried. And so now there's just a bunch of Monero stuck on Secret Network that can't do anything. But also, why would he continue supporting it if he's never gotten money for it? He's passionate about it, yes, but that just happens all the time. They build something really cool, people use it, and then
yeah. Why? And presumably, if you can build that kind of a piece of software, there are plenty of other people that are knocking on your door to be like, "Hey, I would like to give you checks, notes, $1 million to build this venture capital backed thing that does something quite similar but for a different network." And they've gone like, "Oh, yeah, actually, I got a mortgage. I'll take the money, please." Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So reading a little bit more about the local Monero thing, like it seems like, I think your read is probably closer to it. I don't actually think it's, I don't really think it's been cracked down on by anybody. It sounds like it's become abandonware. That's really, like, internal and external factors. That sounds like we are a small team. We now fucking hate each other and we've all been offered other jobs. That's what it sounds like to me. But could be wrong.
I agree. That's one of the things that really surprised me about how Bitcoin still exists. My understanding is that Bitcoin doesn't really have any funding. So it's basically just a bunch of people working on open source software, which is great. But there's got to be a certain point aspect to the developers of like, okay, people are making obscene amounts of money off of this, off of partially my work and my development, and I don't get to see much of it. And that's an ongoing issue with Bitcoin.
There must it must be that the core developers have some kind of line into the miners or something like that, where they're like, look, you guys are making a ton of money, yo, and you're going to need to send some cheddar cheese our way, or this network is going to be in rough shape. There must be some kind of collusion there. Otherwise, like, yeah, the party, like, what, why, you know, if you're a developer and you can work on Bitcoin, why would you work on it for a bit of money when somebody's making hundreds of millions of dollars or whatever? You'd be like, this is ridiculous. Like, it's not worth it. Unless you really, maybe they just really believe in Bitcoin.
I mean, that's because of the Linux, right? Most Linux open source contributors, well, I guess I can't really say most, but many of them do it just because they enjoy open source.
Well, aren't a lot just basically funded by their company to do it because their company makes money and requires the security of that thing?
Yeah, that's why I started rolling back me saying most. Like, what's his name? Guido, the former benevolent dictator for Life of Python. He was hired by Microsoft, hired as a distinguished engineer, and all he did was work on Python, right? Like, he wasn't doing anything for Microsoft. He just got paid a lot to work on Python.
Yeah, and notably, of course, SPJ was hired by Microsoft, and I was about to say just presumably continued doing crazy mind horn stuff, but actually Microsoft released that functional language, didn't they? F#, which,
oh yeah, they did.
Like, you know, you hear Microsoft's releasing a statically typed algebraic data type functional language, and you're just like, okay, I see who's behind this. But yeah, I don't know. There's definitely like a bit of, and again, it's back to the thing of like, if you have a big enough market cap and there's enough money sloshing around, then maybe even just if you say, I am a Bitcoin core developer and put up a tip jar, maybe you just get enough dribble that the dribble becomes actually like a lot of money. I genuinely don't know. It would be, do you know, it'd be really, really interesting, purely from the perspective of who the developers are and what their motivations are and what and how that kind of breaks down is obviously a really important hit, like kind of semi undocumented part of protocol security on every network. But obviously, like, the price tag risk on Bitcoin is that much higher. Especially, is Bitcoin unlike ETH in that there's still mainly one client, or do people, I guess people use multiple, right? Because they also have, there are a lot of different clients for different purposes, like for pools and all that sort of stuff too, right?
Yeah, I think there's multiple clients for Bitcoin as well. There are 952 contributors lifetime of Bitcoin, and it doesn't seem like there's really that many active contributors, which is very interesting to me.
Bitcoin's abandonware, is that it? Is that your hot take, Shortsy?
Well, I'm not saying it's abandonware, but there's fewer contributors than I expected, that's for sure. And it seems like there's only a handful of active developers for it right now. Like, in the last week, it looks like there's been like four, maybe three developers that have done something for it. I don't know. Very interesting. I mean, maybe that's why the last big Bitcoin thing I've heard about is, what was it, Taproot? And Taproot came out like 3 years ago, didn't it?
Wasn't Taproot like a somewhat bad metal band in the early 2000s? Checking the show notes. We've lost a show note daddy. He's out getting cigarettes.
Taproot was in November 2021. So there, I guess, citing Ordinals, but Ordinals wasn't a Bitcoin improvement. That's the last thing I'm aware of that was the biggest Bitcoin change. So 3 years of it without any really big features. That's pretty interesting. I mean, I guess that's why Bitcoin's desired, right? It doesn't have a lot of changes. That's why Bitcoin Cash became a thing. That's why even, I think, Litecoin was a fork of Bitcoin originally. And
yeah, so is Dogecoin. All that. All the Gen 1.
I don't know if
all the Gen 1 blockchains were forks of Bitcoin, I think, originally.
Yeah, that makes sense.
They're all, because they're all Nakamoto consensus, aren't they, under the hood? We've actually got some other stuff in the news chart, but I also, because I just fucking love talking about consensus mechanisms, I saw that there was a bit of Twitter shade going down between some ETH people and some Tendermint people about their preferred, because the ETH proof of stake is the Gasper thingy, right? And they were slinging hot takes backwards and forwards about safety versus liveness, and I was like, now this is the sledging. This is the sledging that I've missed on crypto Twitter. I want people who understand consensus protocols to give each other a shit, like fully, like quite Larry as well. But you're just like, literally, nobody understands these takes. This is brilliant. Like, there's like about halfway down the Twitter thread, somebody even goes like, "This must be the nichest beef in history." But yeah, like people arguing about the cap, people basically like giving each other disses that rely on understanding of the cap theorem is like perfection itself. So yeah,
I like seeing those types of things, but I always feel kind of left out, obviously, whenever people are like going real deep, and you can see that they're like, somehow a gauntlet has been thrown, but you don't have a context to know if it was actually a good one or not.
The other problem is like with the when you get low enough down to the protocols, like there's a lot of detail, like, and it's very fucking subtle. So even if you think you're an expert, you could very, very quickly find that you have your pants around your ankles. Like, and also just because a lot of the mechanisms are so different to one another, like they share some common DNA. Like a lot of the proof of stake networks rely on some version of PBFT, practical Byzantine fault tolerance. But obviously, like BFT, a lot of thinking on BFT predates Lamport and everybody. It goes back a lot earlier, and so there's just innumerable. I was basically trying to get a list a few weeks ago of every blockchain consensus engine that's come out since Bitcoin, and it's a fucking long list, right? And they're all slightly different. They all do slightly different things in slightly different ways, and they use the same terminology. So you're just like, what's a pre-vote in this network versus this one, and blah, 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 blah. But yeah, it's why it's difficult. You know, got to be pretty confident to wade in on a nerd debate at that level. I don't think I think I would probably weigh in and then I would immediately get owned, because I'd be like, it's actually this. And they'd be like, what a fucking CS undergrad take that is. And you'll be like, cry as in doesn't even have CS undergrad would be my... I did history.
Do you think that's part of why a big portion, at least from my take, of tech leads end up being not like tech leads in software or in technical capacities, like CEOs, end up being less technical and more kind of just charismatic, because they're willing to see the criticisms that are valid and just kind of be like, meh, moving on anyway, and keep going with what they're doing. And that leads to success because they're like doing it with authority. Whereas if you're actually wrong, then you have to take a moment to like kind of digest it and accept it.
And then you need to go away and think about it and then agonize about it and then lose a couple of nights sleep and then be like, I need to read further on this subject. And then you realize that 5 days ago, somebody asked you a direct yes, no question about whether or not you could save money on your AWS subscription. And you just walked away from the director of engineering going, muttering to yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And you're like, how am I still employed? These are not problems that you have when you go and run your own company, because you are the one who is making bad decisions for your company. No. Yeah. Welcome.
You do still question how you're still employed though. Daily.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that no matter, so, you know, like imposter syndrome is a big problem within software engineering, like communities.
Yeah.
Typically, it just seems to be this thing that crops up all the time. Like back to what you were kind of saying there, I'm always kind of genuinely quite surprised whenever technical people or people who are ostensibly technical are that confident. I'm always just like, there are some people you meet who are very brilliant and are also able to spin a yarn, right? But they're very few and far between. And so I'm always kind of like, maybe it's just projecting jealousy or whatever. But whenever people are very, very together on that stuff, I'm always just like, so, what was that video game that was really meme-y a couple of years ago? It's like Among Us, you're like, sus. Typing in the chat, sus, super sus, too charismatic, sus. Which, to be fair, is probably true in blockchain. That's actually a reasonable...
I think that's provably true in blockchain. Founders are way more... It seems like founders are more successful when they're not technical than when they are. Bajuran Vitalik, I think he's an outlier, if anything, because he is technical. But even for him, I think he's mostly stepped away from the technical side, has become more of a face of Ethereum.
Yeah, that's my perspective as well. I will say, like, actually, just from the last couple of months where I've been reading a lot of stuff, like, I've gone back to some of his old blog posts and stuff, and they're actually like, he's a pretty good, like, I mean, I imagine that they're just like anything else, like, there are some acknowledgements of like, oh, so-and-so checked this and read this and whatever. Like, other people will have helped. But some of those posts are actually very readable on quite complex subjects and explain them quite well, I think. I don't really like Ethereum. Sorry, I just need to instantly... I said something nice about Vitalik, so I had to then just say I don't like Ethereum to make up for it. So I can't say nice things. It's not possible.
I really enjoyed it, ETH Denver, telling everyone that I wasn't Ethereum aligned. There's always just like moments of like, they just give me a look of like, why are you here? And who do you think you are?
Yep.
I don't know. It sucks to use. What can I say?
I mean, ask me what's absorbed like 10 hours of my week this week, trying to buy Ethereum. So that was fun. So that whole thing boiled down to, there's just so much random shit going on in the UK with, the law is like really clear and the regulation is really, really clear. But individual banks, they're just individual risk tolerance for touching anything related to crypto is just wildly different, right? And you have to be super careful because you basically, it's like a prisoner's dilemma because you don't ever want to tell your bank what you do because some of them have changed their terms of service without, every time your bank or something you use changes their terms of service. Do you read every clause? I don't. But one of our banks had changed its terms of service to be like, if you work in this space, you can't, basically, we don't offer that. And it caused a whole bunch of problems some time ago. And I talked about it on the podcast at the time. And so you're in this weird situation where if you have existing bank account or whatever, you kind of just don't want to reveal what your company does. Because legally speaking, you're in the clear. You're totally fine. It doesn't really matter. As long as you don't do the obvious things that are illegal, we all know are illegal. You're a-okay, but your bank might have a weird problem that they've just introduced at some point, and you're suddenly now breaking their terms of service. So it means that like you kind of just like want to like do as little as possible. And so recently for the DVT, the deep vein thrombosis, distributed validator stuff that we're all investigating at the moment, we've got to get hold of some Ethereum, right? And it's resulted in us having to poke our head above the parapet and actually touch the crypto world. Like with a long barge pole, just push some money over to a crypto exchange and fucking every single alarm went off at the bank. Every alarm, our account got locked. Our card got frozen. We had instantly a message from their anti-fraud team. And then a phone call from their anti-fraud team. And even at that point, I was still so like prisoner's dilemma about it. Like literally prisoner's dilemma, actually, because it was a classic zero knowledge, zero trust situation, right? And I was just like, why are you calling? And they're like, because we think that you are an elevated risk of fraud from this transaction. Like bear in mind, on the transaction is going to the business bank of a major centralized asset exchange, right? And they're like, who are you sending money to? And you're like, I don't have to reveal who that is. With respect, you are my bank. Knowing that they can look on the sheet and Google who it is, they know who it is. They must know who that is. That must be why the alarm bells have gone off. But you're testing them, right? Because you don't know whether you've broken their terms of service. You don't. So you're just like, we have done nothing wrong. And under British law, my understanding is, unless this is an AML CFT check, which we would comply with, if this is a consumer fraud check, we're a business. We're actually not an individual. So consumer harm doesn't fall into it. So we should just be able to make the payment. And they're like, ah, no, but we think you're getting defrauded. And you're like, well, I know I'm not being defrauded. And they're like, well, no, but we think. And you're like, so you're telling me that I don't know whether I'm being defrauded by a supplier or not? And they're like, we're not saying that. And they're like, well, what are you saying? And they're saying, sometimes people are mistaken. And I'm like, so you're saying I'm wrong? And they're like, we're not saying you're wrong. We're saying you might be mistaken. And I'm like, which is the same thing as wrong. And so this has been my
last
year.
That just seems gloriously British. Gloriously British.
It's astonishing. I think I sent you a screen grab of a thing where I'd said, look, we've been talking about this now for 24 hours. I'd appreciate some candor. If this is an AML CFT check, we'll 100% comply with that. That's absolutely fine. I'm not going to provide you with invoices. I'm not going to provide you with business sensitive information to check what is quite a routine transfer for us to a counterparty that we've paid before. I know it's not fraud. I am a director of this company, and my judgment is this is not fraud. And they're like, well, that's fine. We think it might have an element of, you might be the victim of fraud. And I was like, so are you saying that my judgment as a director of this company is not sufficient to move the money of this company in such a way that I judge to be reasonable? And they're like, we're not saying that. I'm like, so then why has this payment not completed? And they're like, well, we think it might be. I was like, so to be clear, you are saying that my judgment is faulty. You are questioning my judgment. And they're like, we don't question the judgment of our customers. And it's been like the most Kafkaesque 2 days. So in the end, they just kept asking for additional documentation. I just said no. I just said no. I don't. You can. There are things you can ask me for as my bank, as our business bank, and that's fine, and we'll provide them. But if you're just saying we think that you're being defrauded, and I say no, I'm not, and we're not as a business, and I know who this is, and I think I strongly suspect you know who this is as well, they didn't reveal what they knew, right? Which is that they must know that is the business bank of Paywood, who are Kraken, and I didn't reveal that it was Paywood Kraken because I wanted to see if they said it to me. And they just kept saying, this is a judgment call. And I kept being like, yes, but you can't stop a payment on a judgment call when I am an authorized person for this.
So did
company.
It go through or no? Is it still in limbo?
they were like, we're going to escalate it to a different team. But they're going to need to see some documentation. This was on, I think, the fifth person that had that had sent stuff through. And I was just like, no, we're not going to provide that. We're not going to provide that. But I'm absolutely happy for you to reverse this transaction, and we will go use a different bank. Like that's totally cool. But like, if you're just saying that we're being defrauded, and I'm telling you we're not, I'll literally just go and use a different bank. Like it's not a big deal. We've obviously paid these guys before with a different bank. We just use this one for ease this time, and it's obviously all gone wrong. And in the end, they unlocked the payment. Like literally just before this show, it was like I got a thing being like, we've done our advanced checks now. Like what checks? What checks? Like it's all fun and games. So yeah, what the fuck? Like trying to buy a couple of ETH is insane in this country now. Presumably because, I mean, like, I kind of understand it, like, as much as I'm, like, complaining about it, like, I guess a lot of people have been scammed via the medium of buying cryptocurrency and sending it to people. which obviously can happen in custodial wallets. So
the interesting thing is, I question if, so I don't know if it's the same over there, but like Visa, like prepaid Visa cards from like Walmart or Target or whatever, those are a huge rectum for scams. I don't think there's any sort of checks and balances for that, right? Like the discrimination is kind of a hard term for me to put it, but discrimination against like crypto utilization.
Like when you go to a grocery store and buy the till, they'll have like an Amazon gift card, like those kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. Huge vector for scams. So like you can go to Target sometimes and you'll see that the entire section has basically been bought out, and you can almost guarantee that that was because someone's being scammed and they're like supposed to pay that scammer in gift cards, right? You would think there'd be some sort of cuts and balances within Target and also within your bank for those, but it seems like it's way more like pointed for exchanges. It feels very akin to me to like pornography, right? Like so many places have cracked down on pornography to the point where you can't pay for pornography, I think, using either Visa or MasterCard in the US. Like an entire sector of cards you just can't pay with, because it might perhaps potentially be related to like sex trafficking.
Yes, like it's a lot of this stuff is like it definitely feels like looking at an outcome and going, what is the outcome we want to drive, and then being like, ooh, wow, this is actually really complicated. Well, anyway, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah, for sure.
And you're like, well, I mean, that's a solution, but is it the solution? I don't know. It's one of those things as well. Like, and yeah, I wasn't even being facetious about the AML CFT stuff. Like, you need AML CFT. Like, it is a healthy and important part of the system. But like, yeah, I think that I'm absolutely out of my lane here, but I would love to do at some point is have like a proper, like just an hour or two with an absolute expert in that policy area, and just be like, just tell me all of the things about what is it that's being tried to achieve. Is it effective? Am I like completely in the dark? And like, I just see this tiny little sliver, and like over here, billions of dollars are like successfully not being laundered and blah, blah, blah. I don't know. Like, I assume I'm just talking from a place of ignorance, but it seems like a fascinating, like misuse of money, whatever that is, like, well, money laundering. I don't know. So anyway, I guess Niall's not coming back. There's probably a good time. Like, it's not, you know what, when it's just the two of us, it's not that fun to, you can't rug Niall. So it's not a lot of joy in it. So, yeah. Peace out.
Deuces.